what's happening. Tell me what's going down. Make yourself at home. This is Reputation Town. Talking public relations to corporate reputations, media communications, all types of situations. Hey, Reputation Town. Reputation Town. Warren and John, tell them how it's going down. Let's go. The Reputation Town Podcast.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Reputation Town Podcast, or as it's also called, White Guys Wearing Glasses Podcast. This is Warren Weeks. I'm joined as always by John Perenak, and we are very excited to have a guest with us today, a legend in the public relations space, and I don't use that word lightly, Dr. Terry Flynn, graduate director and associate professor, master of communications management program at McMaster University, and I think our paths first crossed back in Walkerton many, many years ago. Terry, thanks for being with us today. Very pumped that you're with us to talk about these topics. What's been going on in your world? I know we chatted during the pandemic, but I'd love to hear what's going on with you.
So great to join you. Great to see you. I know that I was on that podcast before, but we just did it audio, so I never got to see your spiky hair. I like that idea. And but no, all is good. Busy with our MCM program, busy recruiting. What's new? I'm a brand new grandfather.
My
new granddaughter, Charlie, came to us mid-November of last year. So I'm having the time of my life. And to have a granddaughter from your daughter, it's a special treat. So that's my life. Things are good.
Congratulations on that. The hair, yeah, my barber got a little aggressive the other day. So thankfully, this is audio only. John, what's happening with you? Anything new? Any off-topic stuff you want to bring up before we jump into the docket?
Yeah, I had a barber experience recently too, where I went in and told the guy, I said, don't be afraid to go too short. And he was not afraid. He fearlessly went ahead and gave me a haircut.
So is that a toupee you're wearing, or was this a while ago? Because it looks like you've got a nice fulsome...
Coming back. It's coming back.
Nice flow. All right, so we're going to jump in. We have a lot of stuff to cover today. Obviously, Kategate is going to be the big one we cover. We're going to save that one until the end because there's a lot of stuff to get into. And it's one of the reasons that we brought Terry here specifically because he penned a piece recently that has gone a little viral in the social media world. So the first one is from the world of media training. And anyone who listens to this show on a regular basis knows that that's something that most of the guests that we have on the show do in some way, shape, or form. And this story is specifically about overcoaching your spokesperson. So, John, you sent this one over. Do you want to set this up? I'm sure most people are familiar with this because it's become a bit of a meme over the past couple of days. But do you want to set this up? And we have some audio also.
Yeah, sure thing. So everyone might know that every year there's a State of the Union speech the president gives to the combined session of Congress. And then after that speech, the opposition party gets a chance to give a rebuttal. So in this case, this year, the Republicans chose a senator from Alabama, Katie Britt, to give the rebuttal. And, you know, a lot of people were criticizing, you know, different parts of the communications component of this, like policy aside. But one of the things that struck everyone was like the how peculiar her delivery was. And I chalked it up to someone who was just super overcoached. And we have a clip actually that shows her normal speaking cadence compared to what you heard that night. And I'm not, maybe we'll just run that first, then we can talk about it.
Sure. And I won't need to set it up because it'll be very obvious which is her normal voice and which was the one from the address.
I am looking forward to delivering the Republican response to the State of the Union. So tune in.
President Biden's border policies are a disgrace. This crisis is despicable. And the truth is, it is almost entirely preventable.
And thank you to all the gentlemen behind me who continue to work diligently to actually secure our border. That's what the American people deserve. But unfortunately, Joe Biden refuses to give that to them.
Mr. President, enough is enough. Innocent Americans are dying, and you only have yourself to blame.
Everything that we put forth that would actually secure and close the border, the Democrats don't want. This is yet another prong of the failed Bidenomics. This is the definition of America last.
The American people are scraping by while President Biden proudly proclaims that Bidenomics is working. Goodness, y'all. Bless his heart.
All right. So that's the variety of clips. I think it's pretty clear which was which. Terry, you're the guest today. So we'll start with you. Is this how you would love to see a media trained client show up on the news?
Well, first of all, this is cringeworthy. I mean, I watched it in real time and thought, what is this? And maybe she was trying out for Saturday Night Live. I don't know, because it was awful. And some of the other things, just the colloquialisms that she was using, y'all, right? Or, you know, the other one that she said at the end of it, really it means, you know, it's a euphemism for, you know, screw you kind of thing. So I don't know who was teaching her, but it epic fail, because she, you know, she's a junior senator, big career. It's not going to derail her, but she's now the laughing stock.
So John, as we're playing the audio, you're just kind of snickering on your screen. What are your thoughts about this? What do you think happens in the room when someone is, because obviously she did this a bunch of times and someone's giving her cues, right? Like, I think more intensity was what she was hearing. But what are your thoughts on this? Where do you think things went wrong? Or is the fact that we're talking about her, is that actually a positive in this day? Like, is there any such thing as bad PR? I never heard of this person a week ago, and now we all know who she is. So is there a method to the madness here?
Well, probably at home it was meaningless, and people in Alabama couldn't care less. I think this is a symptom of when you've got not just one person coaching in the room, but probably five. And they're all sort of trying to amp up, as you said, the emotion or whatever coming from her. And you lose all genuine nature of the person, the way they speak, the way they communicate. And as a result, you get that, which you just heard, where they're not connecting with anyone. It made me also think a little bit about how, you know, remember we talked about the presidents of the Harvard and the other universities in front of Congress, where they just like, common sense was left at the door, and they were coached, you know, by a lawyer essentially to answer a communications oriented question. I think this is the reason why you need to have like smart coaching, a smart media trainer in this case, and how you can deliver those kinds of addresses. And losing all semblance of the person's personality is not the way to do it. But Warren, you must see this all the time when you media train people.
Well, the thing that it puts me in mind of is that there's media training sounds like when a lot of people hear the term media training, they think it's one thing, but it's really a whole spectrum of things. And there are versions of it and varieties and levels. And so I think what you're looking at here is someone who it's almost more of a drama class than actual media training. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot of the work that I do, and I'd be interested in your takes for both of you as well, but a lot of the work that I do is trying to undo a lot of the stereotypes about what media training is. A lot of people think it's not answering the question. No matter what they ask you, give them these three bullets, just say the same thing over and over again, which, you know, I think the average 12-year-old has enough savvy and sophistication to see through that. And the BS detectors are really finely tuned. So a lot of the work that I end up doing is trying to undo a lot of those stereotypes to say, if I see you on the news or if I hear you on the radio, if you're a client that I've worked with, it shouldn't feel or sound like you just came out of a media training session. It should be invisible, right? That's why I call it like the art of the great media interview. It should be, it should sound like a conversation, but there should be some intention to it. And you should, you know, there are times when you're going to get a question that is maybe unfair, or it's maybe a bit of a trap, or it's maybe a false alternative, but there are ways to answer those without just kind of giving the same quote back to them. So that's my view on that. Like there's levels to this. And I think that things like this end up giving media training or presentation training kind of a bad name for the rest of us.
Yeah. I think you have to look at, you know, many different levels, right? Media training is the interaction between somebody who is trying to offer a perspective and journalists who are trying to cover a story. And it's that, you know, it's in some respects a symbiotic relationship, but, you know, in many respects, there could be tension just because of the perception of the journalist or the person who's doing it. And so you have to get beyond that and understand what is the narrative arc that you want to be able to create. And I think the old school way of, you know, this key messages really is a, you know, vestige of old tape days. Right? Because, you know, when they had to go in and splice the tape, the audio tape or video, it took too much time to kind of show this other stuff, right? But now with it all being digital, it's pretty easy to be able to show the continuation of these, you know, these inane types of responses, right? Answering the same thing over and over and over again, right? And most people don't have the communication skills or the political acuity to be able to pull that off, right? Some just go up there and just rip it off, and then just, and you just look at them going, okay, why don't you just mail it in? Because there's nothing there. But I think, you know, when we, you know, when we accuse it to, you know, the junior senator, there were no questions. So she didn't have to worry about that. And so John was right. It's like, this is just rehearsing a presentation. And somebody should have been in the room saying, this is icky. Like, this is really, really icky. Unless she just sort of, you know, freelanced when she did it and it was live and they didn't have anything else. When you talk about the Harvard or the university professors, I again, it's the skill or the counsel of the communicator, her, their people, to not be afraid of their position, right? Like, so what if they're Harvard president? I don't care. You know the arena. You're walking into an arena that you're not comfortable with. You don't ever have to answer these kind of questions. And so it's not even the presentation. It's like, what do you want to walk out with at the end of the day? I don't think we've heard Hunter Biden. We read the transcripts, but I'm interested to see that, because in the transcripts, he comes off pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And again, he's somebody that's lived in this world, right? So you have to know the world in which you're communicating to be able to be effective.
Great point. John, anything else on this one?
No, I say we move on to, I'm just so, my colleague's going to tease me about this, but the whole Kate Middleton thing has become all consuming. And I want to skip to dessert, but let's continue.
Okay. I think we're going to have to, when we post the show, I'll just say the Kate Middleton stuff starts at whatever, and we'll put a timestamp on it. And, you know, I personally have gone out of my way over more than five decades on this planet to have nothing to do with the royal family. And I have to say, I'm like up to my eyeballs in conspiracy theories and all the communication stuff. So yes, John, thanks for the teaser. So the next one is, anyone in the GTA, the Greater Toronto Area, will know that there's been a rash of car thefts. I think, Paranak, you know this pretty closely, don't you?
I have my car stolen from the driveway.
Okay, so...
oh, my God.
This has been happening extensively, and we've all heard stories about cars end up in shipping containers. They go to Montreal, and they're shipped overseas, and they're sold. Like, it's a really, really, really big operation. And so, over the... It's been evolving and getting worse and more violent over the past year. And so what's happening now is people are, instead of just stealing your car from your driveway or reprogramming it, they're actually breaking into people's houses, sometimes three and four people with masks on, often with real guns, and asking and demanding for the keys. And so they'll take the keys, steal the car. And it looks like they're not interested in home invasion or hurting anyone. They just want the keys to the car, but they're actually breaking into your house, sometimes in the middle of the night, taking the keys. And so Toronto police were at a press conference recently, and they were it was kind of a town hall, and they were giving people ideas about how to try to deal with this. And it's a really curious approach. So here it is. We have a City News news clip. It's about 39 seconds.
There's also updated advice for all vehicle owners, a message echoed by Toronto Police speaking at an Etobicoke safety meeting last month. Constable Marco Ricciardi had a new message for vehicle owners who keep their fobs in Faraday pouches.
To prevent the possibility of being attacked in your home, leave your fobs at your front door. Because they're breaking into your home to steal your car. They don't want anything else. A lot of them that they're arresting have guns on them, and they're not toy guns, they're real guns. They're loaded.
That's why Galinsky says they will be installing the door stops and taking YPR's advice seriously. But she'd like more action from police as well.
As I'm watching this, I'm wondering if this is like a skit from The Daily Show or something along those lines. Because, like, isn't this why we have police? But I don't want to put my opinion in here too much. John, why don't we start with you on this one?
So, like, policy aside, this is one of those things where we often say, you know, to be an organization that does communications well, communications should be a function that is distributed throughout the organization. Like, communications is something that should have a lens on whenever you're doing stuff. I think in police, typically communications is that office that's down the hall that you contact once in a while that when you've got something, because had a communicator been involved in this kind of like preparation for, in this case, a community meeting on safety, the idea that, you know what, guys, we're kind of just like throwing in the towel and you should just leave your keys available to have your car stolen is probably not sort of a great sort of reputational position for the police to be taking. And the substance of what they said should have been different as a result, but that didn't happen, obviously. And I think it's just a weakness of many organizations where communications isn't sort of an integrated function in what they do.
You know, I listening to Hall and then considering what they were talking, it reminds me of the advice that police are giving to shop owners. Like when somebody comes in with a gun into your shop, you just give them money, right? Insurance will cover it. If you have insurance, just the most important thing is your own protection and safety. And now to know that they're breaking into houses and that they just want the keys, you know, maybe the better answer was, look, they're going to get it. So how are you going to protect yourself and your family at the same time, just not getting in harm's way? I mean, you can't leave your keys in the car because then the insurance company won't cover the car, right? But at this time, so I agree, John. I mean, you know, to what degree are they really kind of scenarioizing this? Like, what's the best answer? Really leaving it at your door? Is that the best answer? But if they're coming in, you want the trauma on the other side. So yeah, it's a hard one. I mean, this is crazy. The police have lost the war on this one. Those that want the cars are coming to get them. And unless you have a car that doesn't have those kind of fobs, you know, you're likely, and there's certain cars that are more likely to get it. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to go back and say, hey, what about the car manufacturers? What are they saying about this? And what are they doing to prevent this as well?
It's funny you say that. I've always wondered why insurance companies don't go to the car manufacturers and say, like, unless you fix this vulnerability, we're not insuring any more cars that are made by your company. And I bet you fix pretty fast. But
Or we're going to reduce your rankings, right? We're going to reduce your insurance bureau rankings so that people know that when they buy your car, they're going to pay five times the insurance because the likelihood of it to get stolen is greater than the alternative.
But the thing that I think is that when you have a good communications function in an organization, it can actually uncover issues that arose in developing a policy or developing, you know, a program or some sort of initiative that the company or organization is moving forward with, and force the organization to, you know, maybe double think things or, you know, go back and reconsider what's happening. In this case, I think communications could have had them reconsider, like, what is the right policy here? And I know this is a bigger deal, right? Like, you can't just say, oh, we're going to turn the switch tomorrow and there'll be more enforcement and all of a sudden car thefts are going to stop. But clearly it doesn't look good on police to be taking the position to just like, hey guys, just let them have their way.
Yeah.
And what are the unintended consequences of this? Like, if you're a criminal or if you're a gang of people who are organized and steal cars, if I hear this, aren't you just kind of turning up the volume switch and doing more of it? Like, it's, and where does it end? What's next? And I saw this tweet, it's a little over the top, but it says, you know, they don't want to attack you, they just want to steal your car. And then it's like, well, they don't want to rape you, they just want to attack you. Well, they don't want to kill you. And so it just keeps getting worse. And where do you end up? Now, there's a version of this on the other end of the spectrum from Florida. Now, this is going to be just trigger warning for some folks. Things are done a little differently in the States. This is from, just to let you know, this is from a news conference from about a year ago. And it's you can look it up on YouTube. It's called Florida Sheriff Would Prefer Residents Shoot Home Invaders. And here is it's a long piece, but here's just an excerpt that we wanted to share.
And I want to say, as to the person, we don't know which homeowner shot at him. I guess they think that they did something wrong, which they did not. If somebody's breaking in your house, you're more than welcome to shoot them in Santa Rosa County. We prefer that you do, actually. So whoever that was, you're not in trouble. Come see us. We have a gun safety class we put on every other Saturday. And if you take that, you'll shoot a lot better and hopefully you'll save the taxpayers money.
Okay, so different take. The both of you guys are laughing. And I, you know, both may be equally ridiculous on opposite sides of the spectrum, but it brings up, and it's not even a communications issue at this point. To me, it's like, what do you do as a homeowner? So you're just kind of, And in Canada, is famously, the gun laws are very, very strict here. It's very, it's illegal for someone to have a handgun. And a lot of these folks are showing up. So I'll ask each of you, just kind of put you on the spot. What do you do to try to make your home safe and keep people from stealing your car without having to put those poles at the end of your driveway or really crazy door contraptions? What do you do? Paranac, you know, you've been a victim of this. So do you think about this stuff, and how would you protect yourself?
Well, I guess, you know, you could, you know, take the Home Alone approach and create all kinds of elaborate booby traps.
Heat up all the doorknobs.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know. You just keep a place around your house well lit, you know. Just keep an eye on. I find also, like, the more you know your neighbors too, helps a little bit, because they tend to keep an eye on things. You keep an eye on things. I know a lot of times we don't necessarily spend a lot of time outside with neighbors like we used to, maybe 70 years ago, 80 years ago, but or even more recently. But I think that's the kind of stuff that probably works the best.
Terry, you've worked in the States. You were in Memphis. You did a lot of work there, and that's a place that's been riddled with crime and daily shootings. So again, not to switch tracks too much from the PR stuff, but when you hear both of those approaches, what are your thoughts?
Situational awareness, right? I think that's, we lived in New York State as well. We lived in Syracuse when I was doing my PhD as well. And the first night we moved in, our next door neighbor came and said, oh, by the way, two boys just rifled your car because you left it open. Like, okay. Situational awareness, being aware of it. You know, for us, we've got some cameras around the house, but that's not going to stop them. That just might help catch them after the fact. And, you know, I'm not going to go out and sort of run after somebody if I see somebody stealing the car. So I think, you know, you have to take the best precaution that you can to protect yourself and make those decisions. You know, for me, I look at the list of SUVs and vehicles that are more likely to be stolen. Interesting enough, we're a Volkswagen family. They don't appear to be stolen. So now, knock on wood,
yeah.
Something happens. I don't want to join John's club. Thanks.
Just list your address quickly and we'll see. But then, and the funny thing is, in Canada, if someone breaks into your house and for some reason you grab your rifle and shoot them, you go to jail.
Yeah.
And they don't.
100%.
It's bananas. Yeah. Anyway, we'll save that. That's a different podcast. Okay. Next story. TikTok. Desperate TikTok lobbying effort backfires on Capitol Hill. John, you teed this one up. So just give us a quick overview and then we'll kind of break it down.
Sure. So, you know, as a communications agency, there's often a demand for a lot of campaigns. Our agency happens to be integrated with government relations. So we tend to do some campaigns that are directed at maybe affecting policy change or affecting some sort of decision that's happening. And that involves mobilizing stakeholders. And in this case, there was legislation that came in front of the U.S. House of Representatives to, wouldn't necessarily ban TikTok. That's the way TikTok was framing it. But it was forcing the company that owns TikTok to divest its operations in the U.S. Anyway, so they launched a campaign mobilizing people on the app to call their congressional representative to tell them to stop, don't ban TikTok. And I'm just going to read from the BBC story that I was looking at. It said, so what the app was connecting people with their local representatives, and they could be on the phone immediately to their office. And, quote, callers range from teenagers to the elderly, and most were, quote, really confused and calling because TikTok told me to, one Republican staffer revealed. A Democratic staffer said the most aggressive and threatening calls their office received came from adult women. So if I'm a decision maker, this is not making me more likely to, you know, buy into what you're selling when it comes to how I'm going to vote on this piece of legislation. I think this is symptomatic of a couple things. I remember years ago having a call with I won't say who it was, but it was like a major app. It was like the creator of the app. And their view was that as long as they got their user base mobilized and threatening to, you know, like, take at the ballot box or take action at the ballot box or just like put up a fuss, they don't have to worry about what government will do because government will back down. Well, the reality was government didn't back down and they didn't get the way what they wanted. in this case, I think, again, this is a tactic that's more aimed at someone wants to see a lot of action happening. And so do something that creates a lot of action, except in this case, the action is not actually producing the outcome that you want. This is a classic example in my mind of tactics which are not aligned with the strategy. And as a result, the legislation passed that, you know, in the House anyway, doesn't mean it's actually going to be affected into law. This is more of a PR exercise than anything. But that was my take on it. I'd be curious, Terry, you know, from your perspective, what you thought of that.
Yeah, I thought it was quite astonishing, quite frankly, because as we were talking about beforehand, you know, they're micro targeting young users of TikTok and not older users. So I'm on TikTok. I am engaged in a exercise regime now that I get a lot of interesting advice on, but I don't live in the United States, but people my age aren't getting those messages to call the Congress. But 13, 14, 15 year olds are getting, and they're getting the direct phone number for the congressman or congressional representative for their district as well. So obviously they're using the technology to try to influence the behavior of a certain demographic, young Americans at that point. I think it's very dangerous. I think it's done them a lot of disservice. I think it's impacted their reputation. Yeah, it's a bit of a stunt in many respects. The Congress will Congress has passed it already. That Biden's going to sign it because it seems to be in his interest to sign it, but it doesn't look like it'll get past the Senate. So I doubt that will happen. Not to say that the Senate maybe has been taking more political contributions from some of these apps. And so, I think the greater question is, how do you in fact legislate, control, regulate these platforms? Because they are doing significant harm to younger adults and students and demographics as well. And so that becomes the bigger question. And whether or not that can ever happen in the United States, because again, it's ironic, they're trying to shut down a platform, but yet this is a country that believes that the number one rule of life is freedom of speech. And how does that work?
As a parent, it would be irritating to know that they're trying to mobilize your kids in a political fashion. Mm-hmm. It sounds like one of those ideas that someone comes up with at a bar when you're a couple, like half a dozen drinks in. What, hey, you know what we should do? And then they actually do it, and then it kind of backfires. We're going to move along to, I want to make sure we get enough time to get to the juicy royal family stuff. Molson recently announced, and I'm sure everyone's been watching, especially in Canada, the Professional Women's Hockey League, how successful their launch has been. So Molson, a beer company, put out a news release in time for International Women's Day. Molson hides its logo on new PWHL jersey designs to bring greater visibility to women players' names. And so anyone who is a hockey fan, a lot of our listeners are here in Canada, the name of the player is in letters on the back up near the top where the shoulder blades would be. And a lot of these women players have long hair, and so it ends up covering their name so you can't see their name. So Molson basically put their corporate name up in that spot, and they put the player's name under the number in really prominent block letters. And it's one of the few times we get to talk about positive stories here. We usually get out the skeet shooting gun and we're shooting companies down for what they're doing. But overall, this has been really well received. So obviously, at the end of the day, they're trying to sell more beer, trying to get some brand awareness. Just look in the context of Bud Light and everything else that happened there. But what do you think about this? Do you like it? If so, why? And Terry, again, we'll start with you.
Well, I really like it for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think it's just a smart move. It wasn't even something I would have thought of. I coached hockey for many, many years. We had young girls and boys with long hair, and it was just what it was. And to be able to put it at a different place so people can see it, especially in this new league where people are trying to create some level of identification with specific players, right, in terms of, you know, the nurses and the spooners of the world as well. It's also an interesting foray for Molson into, you know, a very highly dominated female market in terms of beer, which has traditionally not been their domain in that respect. So it you know, where do you extend it? You know, just, are you trying to map certain you know, Molson Ultra brand to that because of lower calories, lower carbs. So I think it's the beginning of an interesting play for Molson down the road.
The only thing I'd just say is that it made like dollar for dollar, this is probably the cheapest, like positive reputational bump you could imagine. Like, what do they spend? Maybe $500 per jersey. And they're going to get, you know, the equivalent to millions and millions of dollars of positive media attention from it. So not a bad return.
If that, I don't think the jerseys are that much. I will say though, I mentioned the story to my girlfriend. She said, yeah, because a woman came up with that idea. Like a woman obviously came up with that. That's the reason we didn't.
That's right.
And I was looking at some of my, you know, my eldest daughter played hockey for 5 years when she was like from 5 to 10 or so. And they did the same thing. So they really kind of took this from Tim Hortons, who had sponsored like Timbits kids hockey. They had done that, but to have it transfer, just to make that connection, as you said, is going to be huge leverage and a lot of good PR. So nice for them. Another quick hockey one before we get into the royal family. Promise it's the next one up. Ron McLean recently, and this is funny because Ron McLean is a figure in Canada. He hosts the hockey show on Saturday night, Hockey Night in Canada. And a couple of years ago, Don Cherry famously was sort of evicted from the show and from Coach's Corner, canceled, as it were, in his 80s. So Don Cherry recently celebrated his 90th birthday. And I opened up Twitter the other day and I see a picture of Ron McLean and Don Cherry with the birthday cake. And there's a plate with a knife on it. And they're both giving thumbs up. Ron McLean has this big smile on his face. Don Cherry looks like someone just killed his dog in front of him. And so I'm going to read the tweet verbatim. This is what Ron McLean posted. And I, for the life of me, I can't understand what he's trying to say. But it's us, comma, when grapes hit a milestone and I was chasing one, comma, so, comma, recently, Canadians, us like us, forever. I have no idea what that means. But this looks like an attempt to try to say that everything's all right between these two. So the backstory apparently is that this party was at Don Cherry's son's Tim's house and that Ron McLean had asked if he could show up. I think it would have been too weird for him to show up at Don Cherry's house. And so he shows up. Don Cherry was not aware of it. And what I'm reading from some of the news coverage is that Don Cherry was none too pleased because I don't think he had any plans to be in the same room with this guy again. So the reason I bring it up is not just gossip and TMZ. It's from a reputational management standpoint. Ron McLean seems to be trying to salvage his... again, this is a light, sort of ridiculous story. Terry, we'll start with you. Any thoughts about this? And again, the levels that go here. What's he trying to do, and did it work?
So whose mind is he trying to influence that? Is he trying to clear his own conscience? Maybe the way that he dealt with them? Is he trying to convince Don Cherry fans that, you know, hey, he had no other choice, you know, mea culpa, mea culpa? Or does he have fans, does he still have fans that, you know, support him and think it's the right thing to do? You know, so he's not going to convince Don Cherry fans that this is an authentic apology. I think it's probably authentic. The guy seems to be an authentic guy, but I think he's trying to satisfy his own guilt and not really supporting Don Cherry at that time. Although, you know, some would say that Don Cherry needed to exit at that point, but... so I think it's not going to convince anybody that is a big fan of Don Cherry that this was the right thing to do.
No. John, I see you smiling. Any thoughts?
I was just like, how many people actually remember Hockey Night in Canada anymore that in that way? Like when you look at the way that the media is changing and the way young people are consuming hockey, it's all about Paul Bissonnette and, you know, like, the stuff you see on American hockey channels in the intermission. And by comparison, you look at Canadian broadcasts and it's super boring. I see more people trying to emulate that kind of personality that Bissonnette is bringing. So in many ways, this is like a pointless exercise of reputation rehabilitation. It's like, somebody wanted to rehabilitate the reputation of Enron. Like, who cares?
Time's gone. Yeah.
Ron McLean is the Enron of broadcasters. I think that's what Paranak just said. If you look at it, that's a different way to look at it. But if you look at it historically, the ratings of Hockey Night in Canada, the peak time that people would watch the show was Coach's Corner. And after it was over, the viewership would drop off. Cause a lot of people, you go out to the bar or whatever afterwards, but it's interesting, Terry, your point, like who is he trying, who's this for? And I think a lot of it is so he could sleep a little better at night or try to salvage his reputation. Yep. I'm not going to read all the comments cause there's 1,000 of them, but if you go down the first one, ever apologize for the shameful way you threw him under the bus when you knew damn well he's a good man. Number two, is that the same knife you stabbed him in the back with? The next one, Ron, I'm an immigrant. I love hockey, a sport I didn't know I could care this much about. I've always said this, Don should not have been let go. It would be an amazing day when he returns. I don't think that's going to happen. But anyway, that's the gist of what's happening there. So thought we'd bring that up. Overall, is this the one you said is cringeworthy or that was the other one? That's the word I would use for this. To me, this is a cringeworthy exercise and just leave the guy alone. I will say, though, also, on the record, Don Cherry saved Ron McLean's job on 3 separate occasions over the years. They were going to let him go, and Don Cherry came to bat, saved his job, and then he had the opportunity and didn't do the same. All right, everybody. It's royal family time. The one you've all been waiting for. We should probably just delete all the other stuff we talked about. I don't have to bring everyone up to speed. It's the only thing on social media this week. It's a captivating, disturbing and really fascinating story. Terry, you wrote a piece for The Conversation called The PR Silence Around Princess Kate's Well-Being Fuels Frenzy About Photo Mishap. And it's a piece that's blowing up. So I would love to have your take just before we begin on what the hell do you think is going on here? First of all, like, where do you think she is? I want to hear your conspiracy theory. But on a more serious note, through the lens of this podcast, the communications, the decisions, the strategy, the tactics, because obviously whatever they thought was going to happen didn't. So what's your take on this?
So a big shout out to The Conversation. So for those that don't know The Conversation, it is the website that really focuses on op-eds. So it services both professional and academic markets. So they you can pitch as an academic, you can pitch a story to them, and then they have a pretty big following worldwide. I mean, The Conversation Canada is just part of a franchise that goes across the world. And they came to us and McMaster and our one of our keen communicators in our central office, Wade Hemsworth, sent a note off, said, hey, do you want to follow up on something? And they're trying to do some more of this timeliness as well. So the fun part of this was Alex Sevigny, my co-author and colleague here, sitting down and just bashing it out just like this, because this dynamic that's happening within the Buckingham Palace and Kensington Palace about, you know, Charles doing it right. And that by itself, it needs to be a story, because, it's, you know, we know that it hasn't been a great relationship with the media. And then this issue with Kate as well. And I have to tell you, in some ways, I'm just astonished. We have nearly 10,000 reads in 36 hours on this article. And it is all just seeing some really important newsworthy opinion pieces about health and well-being and economics. So that's the uptake on it. So, you know, how we took it on is saying that, you know, first of all, you need to know the game. You can't be an amateur hour in the position that they hold. And if you try to kind of create this homespun, hey, we're just sending our Instagram post, you know, can't you do it? And then forget the fact that, you know, you Photoshop it. Now, people, you know, an image is already manipulated just because of how it's taken or if it's has filters. But the point was this notion of trust. Can we trust the communications out of Kensington Palace? And are they being transparent? Well, they haven't been transparent about Kate's health. I don't know what's wrong, what's happening with her. It seems to be very serious, because obviously it's taken that long. And the juxtaposition here is that Charles has been very forthcoming about his cancer diagnosis. He's talking about it in a way, because obviously, although I don't think they've said it's prostate cancer, but they really have talked about why men need to be able to check. So that gives us the sense that it's some level of prostate relationship as well. So Buckingham Palace is being transparent and trustworthy, and William's family is not. So that's the kind of mismatch or misalignment that we kind of took that away is that if you want to be seen to be a trustworthy source of information, then you have to be transparent about it. You have to, you know, you can't manipulate. I'd never seen outside of a media newsroom a kill notice go out and them talking about kill notices, right? When we were doing it, our editor at the conversation, I said, oh, I don't really like that word because it feeds into the conspiracy world, yeah. Right? Oh, she's been killed now. No. It's been withdrawn, that kind of thing. But it's obviously there is a frenzy and an appetite for this kind of salacious information. I don't know if you read Spare or listened to a podcast. That gives you kind of insight in that respect. Mm. Where's Kate? Maybe she's holidaying with Megan in California. I don't know.
So there's a clip from BBC. They interviewed someone who's a news director for AFP, a large news agency, and they asked him about that kill notice. And here's that clip from him.
The previous kills we've had have been from, you know, the North Korean news agency or the Iranian news agency, just to give you some background or context. All the agencies validated the photo, which clearly violated our rules because it's actually not even very well photoshopped. You know, it was clearly a lot of problems with the photo. So it shouldn't have been validated. I think as soon as it was, all the photo editors at all the major agencies immediately saw there was a problem and got together and spoke about it and say, what do we do?
Oh, that's interesting. So you actually, you got on the phone with each other or got on a Zoom and all talked, did, yeah. So it was coordinated. Yeah,
exactly, because we're used to working together in what we call the royal pool. So all the agencies work together, and often there's just one photographer who will be covering a royal event for all the other agencies, bearing in mind that virtually the entire world's media subscribes to the agencies. So it's a way of irrigating the whole global media, as it were.
You said that Kensington Palace was a trusted source for you at the AFP. Is it still a trusted source?
No, absolutely not. Like with anything, when you're let down by a source, the bar is raised, and we've got, you know, major issues internally as to how we validated that photo. We shouldn't have done it; violated our guidelines, and therefore, you know, we sent out notes to all our team at the moment to be absolutely super more vigilant about the content coming across our desk, even from what we would call trusted sources.
First thought when they first announced that she was going away for surgery was, this is going to be really interesting to see if they can actually take a 4-month pause and not have the information vacuum implode on itself and start filling with all kinds of crazy things because of, like, I'm not sure there's not, maybe there's, she's maybe one of the top 5 most famous people in the world. I don't know if that strategy actually made sense at all to begin with, but they did it, whatever, it happened. But I think this has turned into an exercise, and maybe the most famous exercise, of what happens when you leave an information vacuum. And then, worse yet, when you start going sideways and you panic and start issuing a fabricated communication in the form of a photograph to try and relieve the pressure, it's the opposite, right? It exponentially raises the pressure. And, you know, now I find myself sitting through like 16-part TikTok videos.
You too, yeah.
On all kinds of crazy conspiracies. I admittedly have spent far too much time doing that. But from a communications perspective, it just goes back to those basic rules, right? Where it's, if you're not controlling the narrative, somebody else is going to fill it in for you, which has happened here. And then there are sort of ham-fisted attempts to, you know, take the pressure off are not working. And I think, Terry, you said it in your story, is that there's obviously something there that they don't want to talk about. And because they have tried to avoid talking about it, they're just inevitably making it much harder for when they do have to.
Well, I think the amazing thing is that the royal family has been like models of not talking about personal health issues, period.
Yeah.
You know, the queen never announced pregnancies until it was visible. And so the contrarian perspective that Charles is leading the narrative on a very personal health story just boggles the mind. Like, I mean, you don't want to wish any family to have these two serious issues happening at the same time. We don't know what Kate's condition is, but somebody again has to be able to speak truth to the power to say, we're not going to be able to hold this for 4 months. All we need to do is give them bite-sized pieces to say she's doing well. We're not going to give you any pictures. Well, yeah, maybe that's part of the problem as well. But, you know, like feed them a little bit at a time and they're not going to bite you. But if you withhold it, they're salivating at the gates and they become rabid. And so any little piece of information and the fact that, you know, I'm sure that maybe that Kensington has manipulated other pictures beforehand, but it didn't matter. But now it matters. And so, you know, I don't get it. I don't know what's happening in that world. I don't really care most days, but it's just astonishing in this world where they've been, you know, they've grown up in it and they've seen it about it, and Harry and Meghan have written about it. You know, that British media will eat you alive. So own the media, just like Charles has. And I, you know, the fact that he's getting huge, you know, empathy and applause for the way that he's done it just speaks about somebody smarter over there at Buckingham than they are at Kensington.
Now, Stephen Colbert made a joke about this on his show a couple of days ago. I didn't see it, but I saw the coverage of it. And apparently Kensington Palace was upset that he had done so without letting them know, giving them a heads up. And I'm like, that may be what they do in the UK. But I know everyone there walks on eggshells around the royal family because you don't want to be kicked out of the circle and not have access anymore. But the fact that someone would think that a late night comedian is going to ask permission to make a joke is, it sounds like they're from a different planet. It really makes you wonder. I'll throw this question out, and I don't know if this is being too hyperbolic, but is this, you know, the Queen has died, and obviously she was holding things together a lot more than I was certainly giving her credit for. It looks like a lot of wheels are falling off the bus. Is this part of an existential crisis for the royal family if we look ahead? Is this, depending on how this ends, because we're right in the middle of it now, is this a crisis for them that they may not recover from?
Oh, the British love their royals. Right. And they also loved royals in crisis. I mean, you would have thought that the Charles and Diana was the crisis that would, you know, rock them in that respect. I think the fact that Charles is doing well and people are rallying around at that point during illness, and that he hasn't done too much since the coronation, where he looked like a, you know, out of some kind of
sponsor for Parquet Margarine.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think the sad part of it is that these are real lives, right? And that William has gone through this kind of thing before. And it's just got to be triggering for him. I think the ones that are having a bit of a chuckle have got to be Harry and Meghan out there and saying, told you. Mm.
So how do you fix this? If you guys were parachuted in and they said, we're desperate for help, what do you do?
Well, I think they have no choice but to give an update, right? I mean, this is not, and what we said in our article, there's a different level of privacy for you and me versus somebody who's ascending to the throne at some day, that they, you know, that the British people believe that they have a right to know about the condition. And you can't say, no, sorry, you know, we'll tell you what we want to tell you. And you have to be forthcoming. And so I think, the best thing to do is to get her and William in front of some kind of big British TV show and have an open conversation about what's going on. And they could turn the story around in a second and to create a very empathetic appeal towards her in a second.
Yeah.
But entrenching and saying, no, we're not going to do anything, is just going to make it worse.
Someone said, all this takes is an intern with an iPhone and 30 seconds to make this go away, just to say, hey guys, I'm here. And I know the whole, you know, never explain, never complain, stiff upper lip and all of that, but this is the biggest trending topic in the world. Everything you look at, you can't not see it. TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, X, whatever you call it. It's such a massive story. And you wonder, are the people managing this in full fight or flight mode, or is this just arrogance? And ultimately, and I don't want to entertain a lot of the conspiracy theories because I'm sure John and Terry have seen them all, but ultimately, at the end of the day, the fact that they haven't done this tells me that she either cannot or will not do this. So either she is incapacitated in some way. Some people are saying she's maybe in a coma related to her surgery, or she's just at a point mentally where she's like, I'm not doing this. I'm not cooperating anymore. So those seem to be the only two that seem to be on the table, unless she's being controlled in some way. I don't know what we're taping this on Friday afternoon. We'll try to get this out this afternoon, but any predictions? And I know our business hates predictions, but what do you think is going to be? Because I feel like over the weekend, there's going to be something. What do you, any guesses as to what we're likely to see?
I think they're going to try and construct some sort of communication that's like well short of what Terry was talking about. But of course, the scrutiny level is through the roof. And so they would have to, you'd have to like, before you did it, you'd have to do a complete wargaming exercise on what is everyone going to say about this to make sure we're not leaving an avenue of attack open that's an obvious one that will just make this worse. Like ultimately what they need to do is they need to figure out what is the thing they don't want to talk about and come up with a strategy on how do you surface it in a way that will control it as best as possible and put you in a position to move forward. But and maybe that's what they're trying to do, right? Like maybe they're in the midst of doing that. And as you said, Warren, maybe it's got to do with the people involved and they're not actually a willing participant at the moment.
No. Or you get, you know, who's got the most trust right now about health issues is Charles.
Yeah.
Maybe you get Charles to come out and say, look, this is personal. It's serious. I have young children involved and I stand behind my son and his wife on this. Done. Right. But if he decides not to do it, then there's, then all the stuff I read about in Spare is true. So
in situations like this, I always picture it as a tire, like an inner tube on one of those big tractor tires. And it just keeps getting inflated, inflated, inflated. And the longer it goes, it's going to blow at some point. But you can't predict when, and you can't predict what the damage is going to be. The story that this reminds me of, and this is from way back in 2009, is the Tiger Woods story. Yeah, whole different world, but the night that he drove into the tree and his wife was chasing him with a golf club and all of that, the number of days between when that happened, and we're talking about a whole different time in terms of social media. There's no TikTok. Twitter is very young, but from the time he hit the tree until the time that he did his tearful press conference, if you remember that, with his sweater and his mom was in the front row and he's crying, 84 days. 84 days, and if you look at all the stuff.
He had to get his face repaired, though. He had to get his teeth repaired, too. So that takes a little bit of time.
But if you look at all of, like, it death by a thousand reputational cuts, where he had the divorce, $150 million, Gatorade drops him, Nike drops him. These are all on different days. Every day, someone's popping up with a, you know, I was with Tiger. I was with Tiger. All these different elements. His golf game is in the toilet. And it just goes to show you that great strategic communications council is not something you can buy. Like these are billionaires we're talking about, and they don't have the wherewithal. Like I literally, and I'm not joking, you could go to Alexa or Siri or whoever your favorite AI app is and say, how do I handle this crisis? Give it the idea, give it the parameters, and whatever you get spit out is going to be better than what we're listening to and watching.
Yeah.
And everyone says, oh, the royal family has a certain way of doing it. It doesn't seem to be working.
The adage that I live by were taught to me by a very mature and seasoned public affairs officer in the U.S. Navy. And she said that she lived by two sort of rules: go ugly early, and bad news doesn't get better with age. And so, if you can just utilize that to say, "Look, it's not going to get any better, right? You got bad news here. Just get it out there. It's good, you know." The cycle will take care of yourself, but now you're creating you're perpetuating it.
Those are great quotes. Can I steal those? Is that okay?
Sure. Just put my name down.
That's right.
I forget what her name is. I remember her face though.
John, before we wrap up the episode, any final thoughts on this? And again, it seems like the most TMZ episode we've had, maybe since the plane lady, but any lessons in this, I guess, from anyone who is running an association in here or somewhere in Canada that they might find themselves in a situation similar to this? Like, obviously, not the same scale, not the royal family, but shit goes wrong, things happen, and then a lot of times the tendency is to, And you hear executives say this, why don't we just kind of wait and see if it blows over? Why don't we just kind of hunker down and see if it blows over? And that's when all the seeds for this are set. So what would your advice be generally to anyone out there who shit hasn't hit the fan yet? They're not dealing with it. Might be 6 months from now, might be 2 years from now. What's that one piece of advice that each of you would give that executive to have kind of tucked away for that rainy day?
It's, you got to think through the scenarios of what may happen and plan for those now. And that exercise of thinking those through will reveal weaknesses in the strategy that you're undertaking. In this case, the weakness was, it just seemed incredible, and I think it's proved impossible, to take the most famous person in the world and tuck them away for 4 months and not say anything about it and expect that it's going to go okay.
Hmm. Great advice. How about Terry? How about yourself?
Well, I think controlling the narrative is the most important part of it, right? And so controlling the narrative means, as John talked about, you know, strategizing where you want to be, you know, at the end of this media encounter or this crisis that you have, and to be able to look at the different decision points that you have to make and what those outcomes are, both intended outcomes and unintended outcomes. And then somebody has to be given the authority to be able to call bullshit, right? And to be able to say, no, that's not how it's going to happen. You know, you're living in a different royal world if you think that the media are just going to go to bed for 4 months and not pay attention. Right. Especially when this other narrative is happening at the same time, where people go, well, if it's okay for them to say, how come it's not okay for you to say? And so why do we have this kind of duplicity that's happening here? So I think that's part of it, is that the counsel that you have has to be strategic, well-managed, and mature enough to be able to, you know, call bullshit when bullshit happens.
And maybe this talks about the value of bringing in external communications advisors who are not emotionally tied and from a fight or flight perspective tied to the issue, that they can be a little bit more objective. The example I always use is Harvey Keitel from Pulp Fiction, when, yeah, it's kind of a rough example, but he comes in and fixes the situation, and he's kind of external. He's outside. He's cold. He's objective, but he knows what to do. And it seems like they might be in this bubble of yes people just telling themselves what to do. So that's the episode for this week. Terry, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're obviously very busy. Where can people find you online? Where should they follow you? And where can they read the article that you just referenced?
So if you go to the Conversation Canada, just Google that. You can see it. It's up on the top of their webpage. Follow me on Twitter, LinkedIn, mcm.humanities.mcmaster.ca. We'll get it to your program. And happy to do this at any time, Warren.
How about your Twitter handle for folks?
Terry Flynn.
There you go. Good, nice and easy.
Yeah. And John, good to see you again.
Likewise.
Glad you finally got beer and wine liquor in the corner stores. Well done.
There you go. All right. Thanks very much, folks, for listening. If you have a chance, please rate, review, or recommend the show. Helps other people to find this content. Thanks a lot for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next time.
What's happening? Tell me what's going down. Make yourself at home. This is Reputation Town. Talking public relations to corporate reputations, media communications, all types of situations. Hey, Reputation Town. Reputation Town. Warren and John, tell them how it's going down. Let's go. The Reputation Town Podcast.